Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, I saw this article and it just made me think. It says UK experts are urging the prioritisation of research into 24 types of deadly pathogen families. And it made me think, exactly how many pathogen families are there that 24 is a low enough number to actually prioritise? Well, Dr. Cliona O'Farrelly is Professor of Comparative Immunology at Trinity College Dublin, and she joins me now. I know, Cliona, we've gone through and we're trying to forget that horrible experience that we had with COVID. But we learned quite a lot about viruses and about disease during that time. We all kind of got a good old science lesson during those horrible years. But that is, while the COVID pandemic is under control relatively, it is not over. And there are other threats that loom quite large on the horizon. When we talk about families of viruses, what exactly are we talking about? What is a family of viruses?
Well, it's kind of like families of any species. And this, it's a really important point to get across that viruses are very different. And so they can be grouped into families depending on how similar they are to one another. A bit like the way elephants are totally different to mice. And they're just two types of mammals. Let's think how different octopuses are from mice. So there are equivalent differences between virus families. And that will inevitably impact on whether a virus is going to stimulate an immune response that protects or an immune response that kills. And so you get a whole range of different responses to the different types of viruses. And we require quite different vaccines against the different families of viruses.
Yeah, and these vaccines may have an effect on all members of a family or on some. Is that right? So if you have a vaccine?
Is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And so with COVID-19, we made a vaccine against spike, the protein that binds the virus onto our cells, onto ACE. But that will not necessarily protect us against all members of that family, the coronavirus. And it certainly won't protect us against other members of other families. So this is why the two sides of the research element needs to be explored. How we make vaccines against them all and how we come to understand them all. But you've just made a point. There are so many of them, we can't possibly understand them all. So therefore, we have to make some attempt to prioritise the research.
How do we do that? Like, I mean, as you say, there's as many viruses as there are probably grains of sand on a beach. How do we prioritise a certain family of virus and put, you know, put resources and time and research and people into something when we just don't know what's out there?
Well, again, very interesting to think about, because for all the viruses that cause diseases, there are probably orders of magnitude more that don't cause any. And it's probably actually as important to study the viruses that don't cause disease. And that's what's very interesting about this exercise. This exercise carried out in the UK was, they developed a tool basically by talking to lots and lots of people to help with the prioritisation of viruses that cause damage, basically. Mm. So on the basis of whether they're very infectious, of whether they cause death or not, whether they're likely to cause a pandemic or an epidemic. But they have neglected, as I said, to look at all of those. I haven't read it completely. Maybe they're recommending some research into the viruses that don't cause disease, because it's as important to learn from, and particularly because some species are much more vulnerable to some viruses than others. Why is that? So again, we need to put a lot of research into the hosts as well as to the viral families.
But this is also a problem with pathogenic viruses, of course, is that they may not cause any damage to a particular animal, but when they make a species jump, they could end up through just a few generations becoming highly dangerous to human beings.
Exactly. Like avian flu is the exact example, which, and that is, comes up close to the top of the pile, of course, because avian flu is jumping from species to species. And we all know that the biggest pandemic, one of the biggest that humans suffered was the 1919 flu pandemic that literally killed 50 million and infected four times as many. So should something like that happen, we will think that COVID was actually relatively mild.
When you talk about these families of viruses that we're looking to prioritise, say, look, we need to keep an eye on these. What makes them in the same family? Is it their shape? Is it Do we look at a sequence of DNA and say this virus DNA is very similar? Is it to do with physical aspects?
Well, all of those contribute. Sometimes it's as simple as whether it's an RNA virus, like hepatitis C, or it's a DNA virus. It depends on whether it's packaged with protein or packaged with membrane around it. So it depends on whether it's huge or tiny. Like some viruses are really, really tiny and some are ginormous. It depends on what their actual target, whether, so we talk about the hepatitis viruses, for example, purely hepatitis A, B, C and D. It sounds like as if they might be the same virus, but the word hepatitis actually means that they induce inflammation in the liver.
Yeah.
So these are four different families, so very, very different. So one vaccine will not protect against all the hepatitis viruses. It's just because they target the same organ.
Right. So in this case, we're probably unhelpfully, we're naming a virus after the affected tissue, in this case being the liver. But actually, the viruses are very different. It makes them sound like they're very similar.
In that case, yes. And so hepatitis, the disease caused by hepatitis B is quite similar to the disease caused by hepatitis B. But the vaccine against one will not, and we don't have a vaccine against hepatitis C. And we're not even quite sure that the one against hepatitis B is as effective as it could be.
So we undertake this research. A lot of this research, of course, happens in the United States. There's a lot of talk going on about how they're prioritizing and deprioritizing research. Have you had any exposure to that? Have you been hearing about your colleagues in the United States and what programs they are throwing out and which ones they're focusing on? Are they doing the same sort of work as this in the UK?
Oh, huge. We're hearing huge amounts. It is so distressing to hear what's going on. I mean, America, the science that was going on in America was just so world class, producing really important therapies and Nobel Prizes and everything. And to watch it being dismantled is so distressing. And ironically, particularly in this field, in the field of infection and defence, and vaccines, because of course of Kennedy being anti-vaccine, and what's really distressing is that there may be loads of other ways of dealing with viral infection besides just vaccines. We need to be able to look at other species and how they defend themselves against infections. So this area of research is so enormous; it needs to be going on right across the planet.
Something that I hadn't really considered is that. A country as large as America defunding research into infectious diseases, is there a danger that it may end up exposing itself to being the source of a very large infection? Because we're looking at measles, for example. We look at the drop in uptake of the measles vaccine leading to measles cases around America. It is small-ish, but it is growing. Yeah. If America defunds research into diseases and pulls the brake on a lot of vaccine programs, is it not a global imperative to put pressure on America to say, we need you, like all the other countries, to keep up your research and uptake of vaccines? Because if you don't, it could, as we saw with COVID, travel worldwide.
Of course.
I mean, claimed that China was responsible, or Trump specifically claimed that China was responsible for COVID. Yes. We might see the same.
Absolutely.
Targeted at the United States.
And it's precisely one of the points you were making there, that it's to do with vaccine knowledge and openness to what science can achieve. I mean, the idea that some people would not immunise their children against measles is just, humans have completely forgotten that measles is a killer. Mm. Now, it doesn't kill everyone. And this is what, again, is misleading. So we need to develop critical thinking, and we need to develop mathematics, and we need an understanding of risk, as well as an understanding of vaccination. And so looking at the whole spectrum of response to infection is really critical.
You seem concerned about that. And I am a little bit concerned about the development of critical skills to engage in understanding, you know, how something works and our understanding of risk. It's something we talked about on last week's programme, of trying to understand certainty and so on. Is that a challenge in the future that we might find it difficult to to build critical thinking in students if we have this in the background, the sort of slop and anti-science stuff that we see travelling around?
And it's not just now, it always has been. I mean, us humans are hardwired to have the look at the two spectrums. We fully expect we're going to live forever.
Yeah.
And we fully expect that something dreadful isn't going to happen. Mm. So we love and we buy lottery tickets, you know, when we know there's a 1 in 1 million chance. So really trying to get humans to think carefully about it. And it's not just students, it's all humans. It is a real challenge.
Yeah. Looking to the future, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this sort of disease X, this sort of hypothetical disease, sort of a placeholder for the next COVID that was developed by the World Health Organization. Do you see things in the news being in your field and you go, uh-oh? Or do you get like phone calls or emails from people saying, this might be the next one? Are you on tenterhooks a bit post-COVID that another COVID is around the corner?
Oh. Us immunologists and infectious diseases microbiologists were on tenterhooks before COVID.
Right, you were skittish anyway.
We were trying to tell everybody epidemics will happen.
Yeah.
Pandemics will happen. It's just what is it and where is it and how serious is it going to be? So, of course, there's going to be something, whether it's in our lifetime. We're also inclined to think in evolutionary times. So to us, whether it's 1 year, 10 years or 100 years, but it is just going to happen. So that's why we need some element of preparedness. And also to have more understanding of the ways that different species resist viral infection. And this is a whole area that has blown open in recent times, is the understanding that bacteria, for example, microbes, are susceptible to viral infection. Mm. And they can detect, they actually have adaptive immunity. They can detect the infection, get rid of it and have memory of it. That was the CRISPR-Cas system that everybody knows. It turns out that CRISPR-Cas, which I'd advise, it's not in just one bacterial species. That has evolved multiple times. So in other words, creatures as teeny as bacteria have evolved multiple ways of defending themselves against viruses. Mm. So understanding how different species defend themselves against viruses is such an important area of research. In our own species, we know that some people do not get some viral infections.
Yeah.
You'll know that that's my own area of research. I'm just really interested in the people who did not get COVID. And I bet you get a few phone calls from this. Why is it that some people do not get a viral infection? There's a very simple answer in some cases.
They're jammy.
Very rare. They're jammy. Exactly. But there's a very simple molecular reason in a very rare number of cases. There's a genetic mutation in the bit that binds to the virus.
Yeah.
But in many others, it's a complex combination of genes, immune genes that combine to give resistance. And that's one of the things that really interests our group.
Yeah. The whole genetic lottery of how we end up the way we are with the quirks that we have from the way we look, the way we behave, how we think, and how we react to our environment. It really is an endlessly fascinating subject.
Exactly. And so important for us to be aware of. Mm. We're completely used to the idea that we all look differently and we speak differently. But yet, during COVID, there was this assumption that we would all behave the same way to this infectious agent and to vaccines. And that the same vaccine would work equally well in all of us. So that's an unbelievably complicated area of research, which is just so essential, and why we need in vitro models and AI models to be able to do it. We simply do not have enough time, expertise, or money to explore all of those avenues. So we need to be able to play mind games on computers and to really explore.
More research required, says scientists. That is the headline.
And three times the national investment in of our GDP in research.
Yeah. Well, I fully support that. And it is always great to have you in the studio. Dr. Cliona O'Farrelly is Professor of Comparative Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Cliona, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.